This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, how to make sense of the U.S.'s operation in Venezuela. It's been just about a week since the world learned of the U.S. special operation to capture Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores. It came after months of mounting U.S. military pressure on the country. Trump has said that the U.S. will run Venezuela for as long as necessary, years even, though what exactly that means remains unclear.
Any kinds of moves like the ones the administration has made in recent days have just immense consequences that can ricochet in countless directions.
That's New Yorker staff writer Jonathan Blitzer.
Just the degree of uncertainty and confusion at a time when the actual human and political consequences are as grave as they are, I think has made this situation absolutely astonishing to try to follow.
Jonathan has been reporting on immigration and foreign policy for years. And the way he sees it, Venezuela sits at the nexus of so many interconnected Trump administration priorities, from stemming migration to addressing drug trafficking to amassing natural resources. I sat down with Jonathan to ask him to untangle the reasons why he says Venezuela has long been an obvious target for Trump and for the people in his orbit.
A few factors at play. To begin with, you have people like Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, who have long had designs on ousting the current regime in Venezuela for a whole host of reasons. And to be clear, the Maduro regime in Venezuela was a brutal, repressive, dictatorial regime. There was never any question about that. And it was, in very obvious ways, illegitimate. Most specifically, in July of 2024, there were national elections in Venezuela. Maduro lost, declared himself the winner, and that was that. And since 2013, for instance, there have been 8 million Venezuelans who have fled the country as it's essentially collapsed. Economic failures, repression, just the country has really been completely upended in the last decade plus. So given that backdrop, you have someone like Rubio, who has always had this ideological position about the need to topple the Venezuelan regime as a way of eradicating the wider region of the kind of scourge of socialist dictatorships. Specifically, what is the main obsession for Rubio is the regime in Cuba. And so Venezuela, the thinking goes, is basically propping up the Cuban regime by giving them oil, essentially providing them with some sort of lifeblood to prop up a failing government in Cuba. And so the logic always was that if you could remove that piece in Venezuela, then the Cuban regime is, you know, on borrowed time. The socialist regime in Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega, is also extremely vulnerable. And so for someone with that kind of design for the region, Venezuela has always loomed large. Then you have the element of Trump and what he represents. Trump is actually a somewhat complicated figure in all of this. In his first administration, he did a lot of saber rattling about the need for regime change in Venezuela. He talked about the idea that Maduro had to be ousted. He tried to use strong rhetoric as a way of scaring or pressuring members of the military in Venezuela to break ranks with the Maduro regime and instigate some kind of coup or transition. None of that worked. But one of the reasons why it didn't work was specifically because Trump himself was uncomfortable with the idea of committing U.S. troops or resources to a more thoroughgoing intervention in Venezuela, which is actually, to be clear, not an unreasonable position. It's a very complicated undertaking. And so he has kind of bounced back and forth among different positions on what the U.S. posture should be vis-a-vis Venezuela. Oil has always been, I think, enormously attractive to him in the sense that Venezuela has some of the largest oil reserves in the world. And yet, because of mismanagement, the actual infrastructure for extracting that oil has fallen into disrepair. There's also then issues like immigration to people who are nativist ideologues like Stephen Miller. There has always been this sense of, okay, we have to do something with Venezuela because Venezuela is responsible for this influx of migrants. And one of the reasons I think why Miller specifically has been circling Venezuela as a target is that he has been making arguments and feeding those arguments to the president now for years about the fact that immigrants living in America right now, particularly those who have recently arrived, and especially those from Venezuela, are all criminals. Of course, this is not true, but that is the claim. And now we're seeing, I think, the kind of foreign policy ramifications of that, that if you believe this worldview, if you subscribe to this worldview, that Maduro was somehow behind this influx of immigrants with this malign purpose of trying to destabilize the United States, then you have a target that you yourself have written into the script. Mm-hmm. So I think that's how the country has kind of emerged, given the different factions that are at play inside the Trump administration. That's how the country has emerged as such a clear target for these political reasons, primarily.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different overlapping factors here as to why Venezuela is on the administration's radar in this way. Let's start to pull some of these apart and try and drill down into these different reasonings. Let's take the war on drugs aspect of it first, as the administration likes to call it. I mean, we've now watched for months U.S. strikes on boats, the administration alleging that these boats are carrying drugs. I mean, what do we actually know at this point? What has the reporting borne out about these boats? Who was on them? What was on them?
I think what's incredibly striking is how little we know, actually, about what was on those boats, who were on those boats. And in many ways, this is precisely the problem, that the United States took unilateral action on the grounds that somehow U.S. intelligence had reason to believe that people on these small vessels in the Caribbean and in parts of the Pacific were transporting drugs to the United States. It's possible some of them were. It's also possible, by the way, that there was a mix of things that, you know, in particular, for instance, the very first boat that was bombed, I remember having conversations with former high-ranking U.S. officials with expertise in the region who all told me to a person how struck they were by the fact that the first boat bombing consisted of an attack on a boat with 11 people on it. Everyone with kind of knowledge of these sorts of operations said to me, very suspicious, very strange that there'd be that many people on one of these boats, because typically drug smuggling operations, every person you have means drugs you can't transport because of the weight. These are small vessels. And so a lot of people said to me immediately after that very first bombing, like, there's something that doesn't add up here, which again, just speaks to the fact that we know next to nothing. And traditionally, what would happen is if the U.S. government thought that there were boats smuggling drugs to the United States, the Coast Guard would intercept them, it would apprehend them, and some sense would be made of what they were actually doing, and that would be that. Obviously, that did not happen in any of these cases. And so I think it had much more to do with the administration's interest in flexing its muscles and in propping up a narrative of drugs overtaking the United States. When the administration initially offered its justification for those strikes, what it said was this was an action taken in national self-defense because the presence of drugs in the United States was causing massive overdoses. The lion's share of overdoses in the United States in recent years, which very much should be a source of concern for any American administration, are the result of fentanyl, not cocaine. Fentanyl does not come from Venezuela or travel along these particular routes. The Coast Guard has never seized fentanyl in the Caribbean Sea. So right out of the gate, the pretense kind of unraveled. So it's hard to even really think about those boat bombings in specific relation to the rationale given by the administration, because no actual factual element of that rationale made sense. I will say, alongside all of that, this happened a little bit later at the end of November, the president pardoned the former president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was serving a 45-year prison sentence in the United States on the charges of narco-terrorism. So the idea somehow that the Trump administration would be concerning itself with Venezuela and the wider region out of concern for drug smuggling and drugs reaching the United States, and then at the same time have the U.S. president pardon someone like Juan Orlando Hernandez, who had already been convicted of basically being responsible for some 400 tons of cocaine reaching the United States in the 8 or so years that he was president of Honduras, it just, again, gives lie to this idea that this has been about stopping the flow of drugs.
And what are the folks that you've spoken to making of it, the people who've watched this region for a long time? I mean, how do they interpret the inconsistency?
When the first of these strikes occurred, I made a bunch of calls. And I essentially heard two different categories of explanation. The first was, and this is coming from people who served in high positions during the first Trump administration, that to Trump's way of thinking, this was a chance to send a message to the wider region, essentially to show them that Trump was willing to do anything, and that this was, insofar as any country in the region questioned what he was doing and whether or not this could impact them if they kind of wound up on the wrong side of Trump on any individual issue, insofar as they were, these foreign leaders were even asking themselves that question, the message was somehow coming through. That was one explanation I heard. Obviously, that's just a sort of general characterization. The more specific thing I heard was that there had been a desire from the president himself, from someone like Stephen Miller, to bomb fentanyl labs in Mexico. The president had talked about this during his first term and was essentially told by the Secretary of Defense, you can't do this. This makes no sense. Mexico is our largest trading partner. It's an ally. We depend on them for all sorts of law enforcement operations. The idea of the U.S. taking military action on the ground in Mexico would completely sever the U.S.'s diplomatic relationship with the country. Who knows what that could even mean on a human or political level, given the fact that we share a border and so on. That idea died on the vine in the first Trump administration, and then kind of lived on among hardline Republican congressmen while Biden was president, and then came back to life. I suppose I'm mixing the metaphor here, but came back to life at the start of the current administration when people like Stephen Miller wanted to dust the idea back off and put it in motion. And once again, they were told, look, this is just counterproductive really in every sense. And so quickly, the idea of bombing fentanyl labs morphed into, according to the explanation I got, morphed into a plan to bomb someone and something else in the region to try to send a similar sort of message. And that's where Venezuela emerged for the reasons that you and I have begun to discuss. You know, Venezuela, for all these different reasons, was on the minds of all of these top-ranking Trump officials. You had in Nicolas Maduro an international pariah, a known bad actor, a dictator who had recently refused to acknowledge his electoral loss. The feeling was that if you took action against a country like Venezuela, which had been the subject of so much recent political rhetoric in the United States, with the president talking about the Venezuelan prison gang Tren de Aragua, talking about drug smuggling and so on, Maduro was becoming increasingly a household name among conservative Republicans, just in terms of how they spoke about immigration, how they spoke about the wider region, that maybe if there was action taken against Venezuela, it would all kind of align with the broader political agenda of the administration, and there'd be relatively little fallout as compared to the sort of fallout you might see if the U.S. were to take this sort of action in a place like Mexico. Now, I want to be clear, that shocked me when I heard that. I mean, the bluntness and kind of myopia of that thinking is really unlike anything I've ever heard. But that was at least the explanation I got.
I mean, let's talk about the oil of it all, right? Another justification that the president has offered is access to Venezuelan oil. He announced this week a plan for Venezuela to give millions of barrels of its oil to the U.S. He's holding talks with U.S. oil companies about building up oil infrastructure in the country. The U.S. has now seized two sanctioned oil tankers linked to Venezuela in the North Atlantic and in the Caribbean. How much does oil appear to be a motivating factor in all of this?
Honestly, it's hard to say. I mean, these aspirations that Trump has voiced of Venezuela handing over all of this oil to the U.S., of American oil companies re-engaging in the country, this is the stuff of years and years and hundreds of millions, if not billions, of dollars of investment. It's all unproven. It's all uncertain. Also, the United States isn't particularly in need of oil. I mean, it's almost as though Trump is speaking of the United States, you know, several decades ago. So that doesn't compute either. The Biden administration, interestingly, in some ways, took more concrete action to allow American oil companies, specifically a company called Chevron, to maintain access, some measure of access to Venezuelan oil. And Trump, initially for political reasons, wanted to undo some of the allowances made by the Biden administration that allowed Chevron to at least keep a foothold in Venezuela. I think it does motivate Trump, as evidenced by just the sheer fact that he's talking about it constantly. And I think to him, and again, I don't want to engage just in sort of cheap psychologizing of the president, but You know, just to judge from the sort of body of his public statements and what we're hearing day in and day out from the administration, I think the oil issue is almost a kind of proxy for his view of America getting to throw its weight around and make demands and extract what it wants. And that's, to my mind, a kind of clearer strain in all of it, almost the symbolism of oil, because the actual mechanics of this are extraordinarily uncertain. And it should be said, too, by the way, American oil companies, you know, obviously are motivated primarily by profits. And so if you're interested primarily by a kind of profit motive or a business bottom line, this is not a stable environment in which to be working right now.
Well, so I do want to talk about what you're saying here about the assertion of power, a power play, a dominance play more than anything else. I mean, we have seen the administration, we've seen the president, but also members of the administration now really align around rhetoric about American dominance, U.S. dominance in the Western Hemisphere. And we've seen really an uptick in that kind of language. It's contributing to the conversation around Greenland. It's now kind of ricocheting around the world, frankly. How do you see that conversation evolving on the global stage?
It's funny. I've actually found in some strange and perverse ways the last 24 to 48 hours to be helpful and revealing of the administration's line of thinking, particularly because of some of the statements that we've heard from the likes of Stephen Miller about Greenland, as you say, and about these kind of broad, I don't even really know what you'd call them, sort of civilizational explanations for what this is all about, that the United States, since the Second World War, I'm referring specifically to a comment that Miller made on CNN, which I think befuddled the host, Jake Tapper, and continues to befuddle me and anyone really who would have listened to it.
The future of the free world, Jake, depends on America being able to assert ourselves and our interests without apology. This whole period that happened after World War II, where the West began apologizing and groveling and begging
I don't even know honestly what you're talking about right now.
I mean, this is a kind of grab bag that I think we're hearing from someone like Miller for all kinds of very idiosyncratic interpretations of the last half century of U.S. and world history. And as far as I can tell, the really only kind of common thread in all of it is Miller's belief that we're right to feel aggrieved for some reason or another, and that this is a chance for the U.S. to somehow bulldoze its way out of those emotions. I don't mean to sound flippant about this. I just, there isn't a kind of geopolitical explanation, not even a legitimate pretense to how the administration is talking about all of this. And so I'm kind of casting about, honestly, journalistically, to try to understand what sort of motivating, not just the administration's recent actions, but even more generally, the way in which it's talking right now. Because there is a world in which, after an action as dramatic as the one the Trump administration has taken in Venezuela in recent days, there's a world in which a sense of de-dramatizing rhetoric can set in. And I actually think in some ways you almost saw Rubio try to do it. There was the Mar-a-Lago press conference that Trump gave on Saturday immediately after Maduro was captured. And I spoke to a number of former Trump administration officials before that press conference. And what some of them said was, okay, it's possible that Trump can claim victory. Maduro, this person who he's been talking about ad nauseum now for years, is out. The U.S. ousted him. There were no American lives lost, never mind the fact that there are dozens of Venezuelan, Cuban lives lost, but whatever. There were no American lives lost in the operation. This is a chance if the Trump administration wanted some sort of notional off-ramp now, Trump could claim it. And that was, in fact, the opposite of what Trump did. Trump himself came out and said that the U.S. would be running the country.
We're going to stay until such time as we're going to run it, essentially, until such time as a proper transition can take place.
Not even Marco Rubio said that. In fact, Marco Rubio at that very press conference, and it's very notable given the fact that Rubio is the chief ideologue when it comes to regime change in Venezuela. Rubio described the operation as a law enforcement operation. There was an indictment out for the capture of Nicolas Maduro for drug-related crimes. The U.S. effectuated that indictment and made its arrest.
Nicolas Maduro was indicted in 2020 in the United States. He is not the legitimate president of Venezuela. That's not just us saying it. The first Trump administration, the Biden administration, the second Trump administration, none of those three recognized him. He's not recognized by the European Union and multiple countries around the world. He is a fugitive of American justice with a $50 million reward.
He was trying, again, to in the face of all the evidence that we were seeing, portray this operation as something that was more limited and more localized around a law enforcement objective. And Trump obliterated that line right there on the podium.
Let's talk about this regime change, even the phrase regime change being used here, right? I mean, we've seen now Maduro's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, is leading the country. You recently wrote that now she finds herself in this strange position of really having to please two distinctly different audiences, one being the Trump administration and the other being the regime that she now helms, really the Maduro regime. Can you speak to how that dynamic is playing out in real time and some of the risks that lie ahead for her?
Absolutely. So a few thoughts on it. First, just speaking in relation to Delcy Rodriguez herself, this is someone who has been one of the staunchest loyalists to Maduro from the very beginning. Her political fortunes are tied to Maduro's rise. She was vice president at the time of Maduro's ouster. She was vice president because Maduro had picked her personally to that role. Her brother was Maduro's chief political strategist. He presided over the National Congress. He was responsible for ramming through the fraudulent 2024 election. Now, this is someone who is implicated in all of the misdeeds of the Maduro regime. And so if the administration, the U.S. administration, comes out and says Maduro was illegitimate, and there's good reason to say that of Maduro, it is a head scratcher to then name his number two, who participated in all of the illegitimacy of that regime, to this new position of power. The regime has always been able to persist without Maduro. Those elements remain in place. And this has always actually been a legitimate political conundrum for anyone who has advocated any sort of regime change or intervention in Venezuela. The Venezuelan opposition has a broad popular mandate. It won national elections in 2024, but it is viewed with hostility and hatred by the very people who control the country, members of the military, members of the government as it is now. And so there was always going to be this question of what you do. And so it seems like the Trump administration threw up its hands, cast the Venezuelan opposition to the side, and decided to allow for Maduro's number two to take power. And then Trump, in his characteristic way, said the day after she was sworn in that if she doesn't do what we say, then she'll suffer a fate worse than Maduro's. Mm. You know, what does this mean for Venezuelans living in Venezuela? It means horrible, unsettling things. One of the things that Maduro had done before he thought he was actually going to be captured, but when it was clear that the U.S. administration was ramping up pressure to dislodge him from power, was he did what most strongmen would do under the circumstances. He took advantage of that political moment to further consolidate his power and further crack down on dissent of any kind in the country. He issued, it looks like, a kind of draft emergency declaration that basically unleashed the government on anyone who was perceived as being an enemy of the country. And any perceived enemy or opponent of the regime suddenly got lumped in with the U.S. interventionists. And so the regime now had a much kind of broader mandate, it felt, to go after anyone and everyone in the country who it didn't like. That is what Delcy Rodriguez is now presiding over. And what we've seen in recent days is a kind of chaos in the streets of different cities in Venezuela, all across the country, in which the government is going after people. These armed vigilante groups that are sort of paramilitaries associated with the regime, called colectivos, are running roughshod over the public. Mm. And so it's been catastrophic for Venezuelans. So you have this kind of duality of, on the one hand, finally, this brutal leader who's repressed the country and run it into the ground for so many years is gone, but the crackdown has intensified.
John, what are you watching for in the next days and weeks? What are you most curious to see play out? What are you anticipating?
I mean, I have to say, I'm overwhelmed by the uncertainty of all of this. And there are people who are more expert than I who really have their finger on the pulse of different dynamics in the Venezuelan political situation. I think from my perch here in the U.S., you know, I'm kind of looking at two things primarily. What the current Venezuelan regime's crackdown on the public there is going to look like, how the current regime is going to harden many of its positions. We're already seeing evidence of it. There's been a lot of reporting about horrors in Venezuela right now, undertaken by the new, can we call it, U.S.-backed regime. That's a very strange notion, the idea of a Chavista regime backed by the U.S. or operating as a kind of puppet of the U.S. Very unclear to me what's going to happen in that way. So I'm very, very keyed into kind of what the human fallout is going to be. I'm just sort of trying to absorb as much of it as I can and understand it. I do think it's going to be a really interesting question. Interesting, maybe it's not the right word. Overwhelming question of what, you know, when Trump says, if Delcy Rodriguez doesn't do what we want, she's going to suffer these horrible consequences. What does the U.S. want right now? The Venezuelan government, when Maduro was at the helm, offered the U.S. great access to its oil reserves. That was meant at the time, this was in late 2025, as an effort to draw down American aggression. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. basically cast that aside and wanted to go after Maduro personally. So what is it that Venezuela can offer the United States, the current regime can offer the United States? What does it mean, basically, to do what the U.S. says? Because it, frankly, doesn't seem clear to me that the U.S. even has a concrete ask, let's say, or a concrete order to make of the current Venezuelan regime. So that's another question. And I think that the third and final thing, and something that I'm in a better position, really, to try to understand and report out, is, you know, what happens now to Venezuelans living in the United States? What we've seen over the last year or so in the current administration in the United States is an administration that is unconcerned with the rule of law in general ways, but most specifically in the immigration space. So you have all kinds of people who have, say, work authorization or some sort of provisional legal status that the administration is just casting aside. And when those people show up, say, for an immigration appointment or for immigration court, are just getting apprehended, detained, and eventually deported. This is a population, the Venezuelan population in particular, that is extraordinarily vulnerable. There are some 600,000 Venezuelans living in the United States under what's called temporary protected status, which is a provisional status that has to be renewed every 18 months. The Trump administration has already tried to cancel TPS for Venezuelans here. There are another tens of thousands of other Venezuelans who came to the United States under a parole program during the Biden years. Those people, in theory, could have applied for some more lasting status, but a lot of them were interrupted by the change in administration. What happens to them? And so that kind of confluence is something that I think I'm going to be spending a lot of time trying to understand more specifically.
Well, John, we'll keep following your reporting, and thank you for making some time to come here and talk to us about it. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We'll include a link to Jonathan Blitzer's reporting for The New Yorker on our show notes page. And every weekend, you can find new episodes of Apple News in Conversation in the Apple News app. Just tap on the audio tab, that's the little headphones at the bottom, to find it.